Okay, ready for the last talk of the day?
Yeah.
Okay. I decided after 2 years ago, I did a talk here called Hacking Ufology 101. It's very difficult to talk about this subject because we're not socially allowed to talk about the subject as if it has credibility. And there is so much craziness in the field and so much misinformation and so much disinformation and so much confusion that to clear away the cobwebs and simply look cleanly and clearly at the evidence, at the evolution of the evidence over the years, at the quality of the people that I know who have done the research using FOIA and spending obsessive years in archives uncovering details of communications among the military and the intelligence and so on, and I'll talk more about that in the course of the talk. You want to just clear away the cobwebs and look cleanly and clearly at what it suggests, what the evidence suggests. Now, there is a famous quote in ufology from Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan's own history is he thought UFOs were quite possible. That is quite possibly the extraterrestrial hypothesis applied to them in his youth. But it's also true that he was a career astronomer, and it was communicated very clearly, as it always is, both formally and informally, that that's not the way to go. And he became very, very skeptical. Skeptical, which I will talk about more in detail too, is a term applied in the UFO world to those who are the equivalent of atheists in the religious world. They are as passionately committed to it can't be and no, as true believers, which are just as bad, are passionately committed to it must be, and it must be exactly the way I think about it. Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And when you repeat a statement like that as many times as he did, and it was current and still is current in discussions of UFOs, you forget what the words actually mean. And I'd like to suggest that we take them apart simply because extraordinary is one kind of speech act and claims and evidence is another. The science around looking at UFOs requires that we remove words like extraordinary from the equation. The only thing that's ever required for a claim is that there be evidence. So the true proper statement is claims require evidence. Period. That's all science asks of us. Because extraordinary is a function of the context in which someone does or does not find it likely to entertain a new hypothesis. Now, I'm not going to review all of the history of science in which so many world-shaking hypotheses were rejected not only at first but for a long time until finally they were accepted. What made it extraordinary was how people thought about it, not the data or the evidence. So that in 1956, when the Royal Astronomer in England said space travel is utter bilge, which is a quote, he was saying space travel is an extraordinary thing, which is impossible. 1957, Sputnik went up. William Harvey discovered the circulation of blood when he published his hypothesis. Do you know that not one medical professional or scientist over the age of 40 ever accepted that hypothesis in their lifetime? It required younger people who had not been socialized to or acculturated to or framed by the impossibility of that being true to simply look at what the data was and see that it was true and then build on it. And that, to me, is the essence of what hacking is about. Hackers, in my understanding from the beginning, and I've been here since 1996, and we'll talk more about that in my talk on Sunday on biohacking, about the qualities of hacking, how they port from one field to another. Hackers don't accept the presuppositions which others would like to lay on them or the obfuscation which they would like to use to make a sane scientific inquiry possible. So I'd like to suggest that we take Hemingway's advice and remove the adjectives. Claims require evidence, period. And what makes a claim extraordinary is contextual, and it usually means it is contrary to the current working consensus or the working hypothesis accepted by more people. E equal MC squared was an extraordinary claim, and it required evidence. It was extraordinary because no one had thought that paradigm-shattering notion before. But once it was thought, it could be tested. And Trinity, the first atomic explosion in New Mexico, provided very non-theoretical, non-computer model sort of evidence that the claim was valid. It ceased to be extraordinary. We have these attitudes about many kinds of what the sociologist Ron Westrom called hidden events. Ron is a sociologist of science at the University of Eastern Michigan, and he has also studied the sociology of ufology for many years. He describes the difficulty that human beings have in communicating or receiving information about anomalies. He mentions an incident which, as it happens, I made the cornerstone of a short story I published called Incident at Wolf Cove, but I had no idea I was making up an incident that had happened, in which the wife refused to discuss the experience she and her husband had when they witnessed the UFO, and her silence contributed to the subsequent divorce. People cannot think, cannot speak, cannot entertain notions that are literally unspeakable, unthinkable, and unentertainable. Ron says, hidden events are the kinds of events like child abuse. You know the history of child abuse as a notion. When people notice the symptoms of battered child syndrome, as we now call it, and tried to articulate them at conferences for doctors, one doctor said, and Ron quoted him, if I thought the kind of people I see in my office were capable of doing this kind of thing, I would leave medicine. That's the kind of reaction you get when something is literally unthinkable. The person who advocated for battered child syndrome said at first he was greeted with incomprehension and silence when he would try to bring it up at conferences. And then only gradually over time did people ask him, not in the sessions in which he mentioned it, but in the hallway afterward, a little more about it and say, you know, I saw symptoms like that. And gradually the tipping point was reached in which the notion that it couldn't happen was overthrown. Part of what we're involved with trying to grasp here when we talk about UFOs is why it is so difficult for us to entertain the notion that theoretically and in the abstract we all believe, I think, is true, which is that sentient life is elsewhere in the universe and in the galaxy, and that we are probably, by the odds, not the top of the food chain, and we are not, by our religious precepts, the apple of God's eyes. So what people do with analogies is something to put on your shelf for the moment, and observe your own mind as I proceed through the data and see what you do with what I present, because that's the best way you can get your own mind around what to do with the inevitable compelling suggestions of the data and the evidence itself. So, it disappeared from polite conversation very early on. You know, the modern era began in 1947, but I'm going to show you data that it was present many more years before that. It was astonishing what was witnessed, what was photographed, and what was reported by credible witnesses. It was also alarming. It raised serious issues of national security. It concerned the military at all levels. It concerned the government at all levels. And in the late 40s and early 50s, they set out to decide what in the world is really going on. And then the subject, after the Robertson panel, and I believe it was 1953, the subject began to be debunked officially. It was poo-pooed. Now, there were good national security reasons for doing this. 1952, so many UFOs were visible around the United States and also over the White House and over critical airspace in Washington, both on radar and by visual sighting, that people called the Pentagon and literally shut down the Pentagon switchboard. And it was perceived, probably correctly, that the Soviets, who were ramping up Cold War strategies, could use the phenomena to interfere with our communication systems, and therefore the phenomena itself had to be disabused of any mystery, and a campaign was carried out very effectively that debunked reports and said it wasn't taken seriously. But meanwhile, the reports were sent to very serious people who took them very seriously indeed. And so when Alan Hynek, who became increasingly frustrated with his role as an astronomer to the Project Blue Book and as a consultant, a role which caused a lot of ambivalence for him because he wanted that role and he wanted access, but he perceived as he stayed in the role that he wasn't being given or told about or shown the best cases, that they were going somewhere else. And Blue Book was handling a public relations effort primarily and not a management of the phenomena primarily. And yet it was Hynek to whom a general in the Pentagon said one day when Hynek was saying, why is this happening? Why am I not getting reports? And he just, in effect, patted him on the shoulder and calmed him down, and he said, Alan, do you really think we would ignore something like this? Now, this to me is suggestive. This is gossip, right? We're not there. And people say, well, that's not scientific evidence. We need repeatable data. But, of course, dinosaur bones aren't repeatable data either. There are all sorts of events and hypotheses in the history of science that don't require laboratory experiments or repeatable data. You find the bone or you don't. You put the animal together or not. There is a triceratops or there isn't. And it isn't a subject of repetition or experiment. Now, can governments keep secrets? Can the government keep a secret like this as long as it seems like some governments have? Well, the answer is, of course. If you know anything about normative practice, I'm not talking about conspiracies, I'm talking about normative practices, including secrecy and compartmented information, with which our government has functioned since the end of World War II in a very different way, of course governments can keep secrets. And something interesting happens to the research into the area when they begin to keep that secret. A number of articles were published in important journals as well as popular magazines about atomic energy up until the time the Manhattan Project began. And at that moment, the subject itself went dark. It disappeared from journals. It went into a cone of silence. It was not in a public space again until Trinity and the explosion of the atomic bomb and then the dropping of those two bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The government can keep secrets very well, and the methodologies which we continue to use and with which I am very conversant from my conversations with people in both the security worlds and the intelligence community, the methodologies are the same, essentially, but they are applied to a world in which digital information creates all sorts of different opportunities. During World War II, there were U-boat attacks. Bodies and debris were washing up all up and down the Atlantic coast. There were oil slicks from sunk vessels, and we did not want to get it out, and it did not get out. The Japanese floated balloon bombs over the ocean to explode wherever they came down, and we made the statements that they never came down east of Idaho throughout the war. But, of course, they came down as far east as Pennsylvania. And in a more modern example, after 9/11, a friend of mine who monitors such things inside one of the agencies said, why don't you take a look at train derailments? Now, this is just a hypothesis. But he noticed the train derailments were up 20%. And we also discovered that 13 train derailers had been stolen from a yard. And I went online, and you have to spend a lot of time searching through minutiae to get data on anything that is intended to not be seen publicly. It turned out there were a lot of train wrecks, and also a lot of them involved catastrophic sorts of cargo, and the coverage was exclusively in small local papers that you might find online, but it was not generally disseminated. Well, if this was an intentional decision, it took something which was potentially an act of terror and turned it into a series of accidents. Now, I'm not saying for sure that that's what happened. I'm just suggesting that there are many ways to handle things that occur and are perceived but are contextualized in a way that makes them impossible to discuss. Now, something other people say when you talk about the government keeping secrets is, don't secrets leak out? Wouldn't things have leaked out? And the answer is, of course they have. That's why you know all about it. Popular culture in 2009 knows all about UFO phenomena. But officially, it is not investigated. It is not researched. Once in a while, you have a study of sociology or psychology. So who in this room does not know what a UFO is? All right. You all know about it, and you all know certain stories about it. You may not be sure which are true and which are not, but you do know certain stories. And what I was afraid was going to happen is happening. I've got an hour. I was going to try to keep this to 5 10-minute modules. First module is already over 5 or 10 minutes. So I'm going to tell you in a modular fashion the key elements of my presentation, not all the details. Anybody who wants the details, we can talk about how to get them later. Let's talk for a moment about the history of the phenomena. I said that it began long before 1947. 1947 is when Kenneth Arnold made the first publicly noticed report. Actually, other UFOs of a description similar to what Kenneth Arnold reported near Mount Rainier in Washington had been reported earlier and elsewhere in the country. But 1947 is when we mark that people became aware of it because the newspapers picked it up. But there were many, many sightings before not only 1947 but World War II and before this century. Are you familiar with the work of Charles Fort? Okay, Charles Fort was, now, I mean, hackers should understand this kind of mentality. Edward O. Wilson, who wrote Consilience, great social biologist, said that scientists are characterized by three driving forces, passion, daring, they're willing to take extraordinary risks, and obsessiveness. You have to be absolutely obsessive about learning something, especially today, in order to really do a job on it, and that characterizes hackers as well. Well, Fort was absolutely obsessive. Through health reversals, came back to this country, had enough money to live, went to the library in New York, early part of the century, and he went through every periodical he could from all over the world, and he took note of all of the anomalous things that were not noted because they literally could not be thought elsewhere, but they were all reported in all of these little isolated sorts of journals and periodicals. And this was in the early part of the century. He lived from 1874 until 1932. And strange objects in the sky were reported in this time with increasing frequency. But each one was treated as if it was a one-time occurrence. And that's one thing I want to emphasize. When you look at the pattern of the evidence, it shows you one thing. If you take each case one by one, then you look at it in a granular way and it shows you something else. But far from being isolated, what Fort discovered in reviewing all of this periodical material from all over the world was that they were not an isolated phenomena at all, but part of a much larger and connected phenomena. He spent hours at the library pursuing this, paging through newspapers and scientific journals. Scientists were refusing to acknowledge the world was full of phenomena and events that did not fit with their theories, which drove him nuts, the way it drives some of us nuts. Scientific attempts to explain away strange events like UFO sightings were laughably inadequate, and he wrote that their explanations were no less crazy than his ideas. Science is established preposterousness, he declared. Science of today, superstition of tomorrow. Science of tomorrow, superstition of today. But behind the joking, he advanced his clear hypothesis based on the data he found, that sightings of craft-like objects indicated extraterrestrial visits to the Earth. And he also understood humanity's resistance to such a fantastic and threatening notion. Here's a typical event which Jerry Clark talked about. Jerry Clark is a dear friend and a longtime researcher and the author of the UFO Encyclopedia, which is the best single compendium in the field, the UFO Encyclopedia, volume, second edition. He was recently awarded the Dinsdale Award for his lifelong work with anomalies as an anomalist. And he recited this story. This is from 1887, an upstate New York newspaper. Someone in a village wrote, "Perhaps I might interest your readers if I should tell of a strange phenomena. I'll rush through it. Sitting at a window, looking out, the forest suddenly sparkled and glistened. I began to look around for the cause, and I can only describe it as between the heavens and the earth, at a rapid rate, like silver balls or silver coins, bright and sparkling, rushing through the air, and finally disappearing below the clouds." This is a classic UFO sighting from 1887. And I will refer to the later to the RB-47 case, which is the single best documented case of multiple witness and radar traces that we have got, so that when people say, "Well, show me just one case," the debunkers and the skeptics do not ever talk about the RB-47 case. And I'll give you more details about it. But for a normal human being looking at the data, as Fort did in the early part of the 20th century, the evidence is compelling. The extraterrestrial hypothesis, in other words, we will discover, is the most likely, and what I challenge people to provide, not for identified flying objects, of which 80% of the sightings consist, but for the data and evidence on record, is an alternative hypothesis that, when you look at the data and evidence, makes as much sense as that one. The way an intelligence analyst at the National Security Agency put it to me, Richard, he said, for a considerable period of time, there has been what he called a cultural intrusion of other intelligent life into the psychosphere of humanity. And for our own political, economic, social, and cultural reasons, we see it and we know it and we discuss it in popular culture as we are here, but we limit our discussion with an official refusal to acknowledge its reality, of which ridicule is the hallmark. This man lectures on deception at the Cryptologic Museum still today, I think, for NSA. And he tells me the three hallmarks of deception are always the same: illusion, misdirection, and ridicule. And when something has leaked out or been observed so widely as this phenomena has, then ridicule is the best defense because people become afraid to talk about it. I hesitated for years, and I finally decided, what the hell? I'm semi-retired. For 30 years, I've listened to people tell me their stories and listened to serious researchers behind the scenes, off the record, talk about it. And I finally simply want to say outright, there is no other hypothesis that I have seen in 30 years than the extraterrestrial. My interest in it began in 1978 when I was an Episcopal priest, and the colonel sitting in the church basement, he was then a major, retired, a bird colonel from the Air Force. We were sitting in our church basement, 1978, Close Encounters had just come out, and I had read Hynek and Vallée and the other people and grown up with the phenomenon in the papers, that I said, Bob, he was a fighter pilot, heavily decorated. Bob, I don't understand. I read these guys, and they say that you and your fastest fighters, which he flew, chase these things and you can't catch them. And he said, looking perplexed, well, you're right. We chase these goddamn things and we can't catch them. Now, that woke me up, recontextualized my understanding that these were not just great stories, not folk legends, not folklore, not just nonsense, not just craziness, but one of the most credible people I know, heavily decorated in Vietnam, a fighter pilot, retired bird colonel, now works in computer security, of course, and verified by email the truth of that encounter because I wanted to make sure I was saying the same. As the NSA analyst said in a different context, ants just don't get that dogs exist. They're here, he said. And he paused. We were having lunch in Maryland, and he said again, they're here. But ants just don't get that dogs exist. Sure, there's gossip like that. I like the gossip stories. They're fun. Like the guy from DIA who was talking about something else and the subject came up and he suddenly hit his hand on the podium like that and he said, yes, we know they're here and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. Or a friend who went mountain climbing with Dan Golden, former executive from NASA, in Africa where the air gets thin up on Kilimanjaro and the camaraderie gets deep. And the subject came up, and he said that Golden told him, yes, yes, we know they've been here, but if you say I said so, I'll call you a liar. Or the commercial airline pilot who said to me, recounting his own two incidents, because there have been thousands of incidents with commercial airlines that have been documented in a database that Richard Haynes, former psychologist at NASA, has created. Again, the stuff is there, and you have to simply look at it and put it together and see it clearly. What he said is, all you have to hear is one conversation, like the one I had, where a pilot said officially what he saw up there, and his boss said, you must have been drinking. Now, if you're an airline pilot, all you need to be is accused once of being a drunk, and your career is threatened, the same way one of the NASA spokesmen said, I think it was Deke Slayton, I'm not sure, it was one of the astronauts, who was insisting that what he saw was anomalous. And he said, oh, he's just one of our bleary-eyed astronauts. These are coded statements that say, if you're an astronaut and bleary-eyed, you don't fly. You don't go into space. Now, my friend at NSA is the same person who acknowledged that he wrote an unclassified document now that was circulated at NSA in the 1970s, articulating the various kinds of responses of cultures to a superior technological civilization, which these things obviously represented. I had read that paper, but it wasn't associated with any name. But as I got to know him, and we talked a lot and became close friends, I recognized everything in it, the way it was written. Cadences were his, and I was having lunch with him again. I said, it sounds like you, feels like you, it's the way you talk, it's the way you talk about it. And there was a long silence, and then he said, okay, who's fucking with who? He wrote it. Well, other people have said things like that in the past. Margaret Mead. Do you know the name Margaret Mead? Great anthropologist, coming of age in Samoa, wasn't always right, but was always brilliant. Margaret Reed wrote an article. These articles are around for the reading. You just have to look for them. This was in Red Book in 1974, September 1974. She says, I'm always asked by people, do you believe in UFOs? This is a silly question, born of confusion, she wrote. Belief has nothing to do with UFOs. Belief is about matters of faith. It's not about the kind of knowledge based on a scientific inquiry. And she goes on to say, thousands of sightings, the very same thing in 74, that was said in 54, that it said in 94, that I'm saying in 2009, thousands of sightings have been reported, not only by individuals, alone at night, by the spectacle of a shining disc hovering soundlessly over the trees, or apparently coming down, taking off at a great burst of speed, but by pilots who have continually reported sightings, and sometimes several planes have given chase, always unsuccessfully. Occasionally, many people have watched stunned the same UFO event, and she mentions the 1954 Great Wave in Europe, where Aimé Michel, extraordinary researcher and philosopher, using the resources of the French, you know, when the French do it, the Comita report, released not too long ago, about the French investigation of the UFOs. Because, yes, they're global. And the same phenomenon is reported in the same ways from all over the world, from every country. And as my friend at NSA says, something funny here is not funny everywhere. Something funny for 15 minutes is not funny for 60 years, as it's been documented. And besides, he said, the reports agree in the small details. So 1954, there was a tremendous amount of sightings in France. And in France, the way they investigate is they have a national police force who carry out the investigations according to a similar, self-similar methodology. In other words, they use scientific approaches and verified landing traces, physical effects, multiple witness events, and in many cases, the observance of humanoid creatures, that is, creatures who are generally the same morphology as us, but sometimes smaller, sometimes larger, often seen near the craft, getting out of the craft departing at high speeds. The question, of course, is this all crazy? And watch what your mind is doing with this, because I'm just kind of bullying ahead, kind of straightforwardly, just trying to press all this in there. And what we're talking about is replacing the cornerstone of our philosophical, religious, and societal assumptions about who we are. It would cause us to remythologize our entire history, to wake up and realize that what has happened, as has been so well documented for so many years, has in fact happened. Because it would cause us to question our assumptions. And as we'll see later, I hope, if I can get through this material, that might be one of the reasons why there has been a hesitation to discuss this openly and disclose it. I'm not going to go through all the history. I'm currently engaged in a book project with some of the better researchers. They're all far better than I. They've done this for decades. Professors, scientists, Jerry Clark, I mentioned, who wrote the UFO Encyclopedia, Brad Sparks, Mike Swords, Richard Hall, who was the director of NICAP and recently died, unfortunately. I spent time with him about 6 months before he died, sitting in his house near Washington, D.C., because I visited all of these people in an attempt to say, look, I've looked at this for 30 years, and I want to know from you, the best minds who have looked at it, the most sober and sane, who tolerate no nonsense, who won't entertain the silliness of the UFO world, the subculture, I want to know what you think now. And from each one of them came the same kinds of reflections that I'm giving you now. Mike Swords wrote an article. He was a professor at Western Michigan, retired now, and he's the main author of our book. The book looks at the response of the government from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, not only in this country, but chapters dedicated to Australia, to England, to France, to Spain, and to other countries where it has also been investigated by serious researchers. And Mike said, why is it that when anybody takes the best cases, the best evidence, as we do, look at Jim McDonald's extraordinary work when he tried to push the scientific establishment into taking it seriously. There are other compendiums, Lauren Gross, who year by year documented in the most painstaking way the phenomena and the reports. He said, why is it that we're still asking the same questions? Why are we still stuck on zero? Why are we right where we were in 74 or 64 or 84. And they asked the same questions again and again, because the phenomena manifested itself in ways that was easily detectable. What kinds of things did people say when the phenomena showed up? What are the reports? What kinds of attributes of these dynamic aerial objects are consistently reported? Electromagnetic effects, with effects on electrical currents, especially in vehicles. You know how cars stop and then start again. You know how lights flicker and then go out. Landing reports, often with touchdowns, physical markings left on the ground, near landings, hovering just above the ground, pacing of vehicles, including UFOs blocking the highway, physiological effects on UFO witnesses, eye damage, burns, paralysis, microwave radiation, it looks like, radioactivity measured at the site, radar cases, and in some cases, multiple radar and visual cases. Other physical effects such as sounds, shock waves. If some other mechanism, Richard Hall said in one of his writings, actually before the Condon Committee appointed by Congress, can be discovered to account for these effects, then UFOs and their significance might be discounted. But if these effects fairly commonly associated with and possibly caused by them really are, they should provide many clues to the actual nature of UFOs. We could not do then, when these effects were reported, what they did. But many of them, as I will hopefully be able to articulate, we can do now. And any recent conference on the latest non-lethal weapons, or beam weapons, or heat weapons, or paralysis rays, or invisibility, or stealth technology, all things which were said to be impossible when these things were witnessed in the 40s and 50s, nevertheless somehow found their ways as ideas motivating research toward their realization and actualization in our own military and our own society. And I think that's not just an accident. So, debunkers debunk. Skeptics are skeptical. But the debunkers never make their own best efforts to seek out the best UFO evidence. They pick identified flying objects. They never picked the RB-47 case. They cannot be trusted in an honest intellectual debate because honest scholars would examine the evidence and allow it to speak to them. They go over the same cases again and again and again. And it has provoked, I suggest, even in UFO researchers who want to take this seriously, people are terrified of being ridiculed because of what it does to your career. Let me give you just a trivial example from my life because it didn't affect my career that much. But I did some significant work on intelligence and ethics with people who were engaged in attempting to develop an ethical code of conduct for the intelligence community. I know that may sound like, how can those two go together? But I guess they are saying, that within the context of what we have to do in intelligence, how is it that we can do it as ethically as possible? I was invited to be on the board of the Intelligence Ethics Association because I had contributed in significant ways to organizing some of the activities at the conferences. One of the board members who was I think Lieutenant Colonel, a major, I'm not sure, I won't say his name, but he went to my website. Now my website, like this book, Islands in the Clickstream, about 150 columns, there's 30 or 35 short stories, there's numerous voluminous amount of information and papers and articles and stories that I've written over the years. But the one that he picked up on was called The Evidence for the Evidence. Is there evidence for UFOs? Very conservative, very low key, just saying, not like this talk, just saying it should be investigated scientifically. And he went nuts and went back to the board and said, if they see that we're associated with someone who will speak about this in public without hiding it, they'll think we're all loonies. Now, you can say, how outrageous. But as a result, one of the board members called and said, it's really very basic. Take everything you said about UFOs off your website and don't mention it in public again, and we'd be glad to have you on the board. It was kind of like when I was asked if I would like to do consulting at considerable remuneration for Aramco in Saudi Arabia. And then I got a call back, and he said, you were in Israel. You say so on your website that you worked for Microsoft in Israel and you've worked with Jews, and what we'd like you to do is remove every reference to Israel and Jews from everything on your website, and then you can come to Saudi Arabia and work here. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that either. So in neither case, I didn't go onto the board, and I skipped the job in Saudi Arabia. Ridicule is powerful. The threat, because it still pisses me off, right, that the little colonel, and of course he is a little guy, would be so terrified of suggesting that you investigate something scientifically that people will think he is a loony if he is associated with someone who does it. Okay, so what kinds of evidence do we have? We have some photographs that seem legitimate. We know that gun camera photographs were taken by jets scrambled to pursue UFOs. We had films, Tree Mountain film, Utah film, other films, that could not have easily been faked. My friend Jeff Sanyo, who does engineering for Quad Graphics and analyzes UFO photos and films, said either people all over the world are using the most sophisticated photo manipulation devices, far beyond Photoshop, or people are photographing and sending me examples of the same things. One of the famous ones was taken in 1952, I think, by Paul Trent in McMinnville, Oregon. You can go on the web and look at these. You can look at Paul Kimball's top 10 UFO sightings and just look at those as a place to start. And the UFO that he photographed in the sky above his farm near McMinnville is identical to one that was photographed at the same time, roughly, in Rouen, France. They're real photos. But we also have things that show up often years later. Wilbert Smith was a Canadian minister who made the statement, which was subsequently quoted, that yes, UFOs are real. Early on, this is, 50s. Yes, they are real, and they are at the highest classification of secrecy in the U.S. government. Now, how did he know about that? Well, we found a memo. This is the kind of work the researchers do. This is Robert Sarbacher, who was a prominent industrialist working with Vannevar Bush, whose name comes up in this context a lot. And he was interviewed. Here's a transcript found in Wilbur Smith's own handwriting in his personal files and not made public until the 1980s when it was discovered. Smith, the Canadian minister, said, I'm doing work on the collapse of the Earth's magnetic field as a source of energy. I think our work may have some bearing on flying saucers. What do you want to know? Smith said, I've read Frank Scully's book on the saucers. I'd like to know how much is true. The facts reported in the book, said Sarbacher, are substantially correct. Then the saucers exist? Yes, they exist. Do they operate, as Scully suggests, on magnetic principles? We have not been able to duplicate their performance. So they do come from some other planet? All we know is we didn't make them, and it's pretty certain they didn't originate on the Earth. I understand the whole subject of saucers is classified. Yes, it is classified 2 points higher than the H-bomb. In fact, it is the most highly classified subject, he said, in the U.S. government at the present time. One of the questions, there's more on that, one of the questions you want to ask, the memo exists. Now, I'm just giving you tidbits of the documentation unearthed from archives and from serious research that suggests conversations like that taking place. Why is it not out here? We investigate snail darters. We look at hamsters and their reproductive habits. We pick the smallest and most arcane sorts of areas as suitable for research. And yet something as momentous as this, why isn't it out here? Well, one of the answers may be that it's in there. That, of course, as the general said to Hynek, do you think we're going to ignore something as important as this? Of course it hasn't been ignored. But it's been treated differently than an object of simple scientific experimentation or investigation. I am so sorry. I only have 20 minutes to go. So much stuff. Science and engineers who made reports. New York Times, 52. Life Magazine, 52. typical by the hundreds. Middletown, Pennsylvania, several round and silver saucers and cigar-shaped objects reported flying high over Jersey Shore, said an Air Force officer. Captain Lloyd of the Olmsted Air Force has said Army Captain Harold Herman and his wife reported seeing a round silver saucer-like object flying fast across the sky. They were reported, New York Times, until it was shut down, until they stopped being reported, except in silly ways, by the National Enquirer. One of my favorite headlines was, "Space aliens drained my blood and replaced it with a yellow viscous fluid." And you see that on the supermarket enough, and I hope I have time to get to that. I've mentioned before where the National Enquirer likely came from. And I have quotes from, say, Fletcher Prouty on how the CIA financed various kinds of alternative activities by making sure funds moved to them covertly. It would blow people's minds to know the normal organizational structures which have worked hand in glove with the CIA over the years. I was once sitting with the CEO of a major insurance company and talking somewhat in this vein about intelligence. And he said, "Well, you know, we have offices in most of the capitals of the world." He said, "We always had somebody down the hall." Because when you think about it, where else would you go for people and businesses to give all of their important data to an organizational structure? So, of course, it's filtered through insurance companies that have a global presence. Take a look sometime at where some of the major travel guides got their start. People being sent to corners of the world, all over the most arcane places, and look at who funded these, in essence, investigative expeditions. Well, when you look at the National Enquirer, I don't know if I'll get to all the quotes, but the money that funneled into it, it was started in 1953 by Generoso Pope. 1952, he had done psychological operations for the CIA. He decided that was silly, so he quit and started the National Enquirer. It didn't make money until 1960, about, 58, 59, 60. For 6-7 years, several $100,000 was moved into the Enquirer. Through who? Through his good friend Frank Costello, the mafia chieftain in New York, who moved the money to the National Enquirer over those years because it never made any money until it finally did. There is a history of periodicals, magazines, and books being published both covertly and overtly by the intelligence agencies in order to achieve all sorts of purposes, and creating nefarious, idiotic ones like the tabloids has had a powerful effect on the people who read them and on national popular culture. And so, of course, it would be a natural place to put material to debunk it if a story just refuses to go away, like the famous visitations at the ICBM base in Montana, which wasn't covered for 3-4 years and was finally covered when it finally made national news by the Enquirer, which appropriately killed the story. There are all sorts of ways to handle it. There's a case which I won't read in its entirety, but it was just Air Force officers, legitimate, credible people from Portugal. Just to make the point that cases like this have come in from all over the world. It lasted 40 minutes. The object dropped 4 luminous rings, which flew separately in the sky around the jet. Suddenly they disappeared. The observers noted a loss of radio connection. The 4 pilots have their testimonies published. They are all senior pilots with a high amount of flights. As I said, Richard Hayes has compiled a database in the interest of aviation safety because some of the incidents seriously reflect a threat to aviation safety. So there are numerous pilot reports on record which can be calibrated, corroborated, and checked. Here you have a pilot reporting 2 intelligently controlled objects, Lieutenant Colonel, whatever. They were not propelled by any thermodynamic. I can just read them all night. And I don't know any sane, reasonable person who does not read case after case after case of reasonably well-documented reports who does not come to the conclusion that they are at the very least reporting things that were real, that over the years insisted on their presence being manifest in the forms that they were, and which we could not do, and no one else could do either. The RB-47 radar visual case, to which I've referred several times, it was one of the top cases investigated by James McDonald in the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. He was a scientist. Brad Sparks has done the most thorough research. I can only encourage you, because it's 20 pages long, documenting the radar reports, the kind of radar used, where the traces were picked up, and how they all calibrated to point to the same objects. The pilot visual record and the various radar reports all point to a single event that all were observing. They correlate precisely, Jerry Clark says, with electronic measurements of microwave signals emitted by the UFO and with eyewitness visual observations and radar tracks. Sparks' research is based on the complete Condon Committee file, the files of James McDonald, the NICAP files, as well as portions of CLASSIS files, plus scientific, technical, and historical data from Boeing, GE, American Airlines, National Climatic Data Center, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just trying to make the case that these are not idiots. These are not morons. These are not cottage industry people trying to score a buck on a gullible public. These are serious intellectual researchers who have examined the cases. I'll take questions in a minute. Who have examined the cases with an intention of finding out what has happened. And in every single of one of the people I've mentioned, they are quick to get rid of IFOs, identified flying objects, and to try every possible explanation to see if they fit some other category before coming to the conclusion that there's nothing that we know that can describe them. One of the most famous cases is the 1976 Iranian fighter case. Parviz Jafarian, a retired general of the Iranian Air Force, contrary to popular propaganda of the recent weeks. The Iranians are not idiots, and they're pretty good with their military. This was during a time when we were their military, because the Shah was our dictator, and we were supplying the F-4s to these people. I'm not going to read the whole case. I encourage you to read it. It's not hidden or secret. Why? Because a DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency report, happened to find its way into the public, and the DIA report describes the incident exactly as this general at a subsequent press conference not long ago in Washington described it, because it was significant in that, one, the fighter jet locked its radar and armed itself, armed its weapons, aimed at the UFO. It was immediately shut down. Its armaments were disarmed in the same way that another friend, Robert Hastings, has looked for 30 years at the numerous incidents over nuclear installations and Air Force missile bases, and in one case has numerous people testifying to the fact that the codes were tampered with and the ability of the missiles to fly was shut down. Well, this came from DIA. It leaked out. Things do leak out. Things get out. And these boxes are checked, confirmed by other sources, value of information. They had a choice of not at all, low, medium, and high, high. Because they interviewed the pilots. We do go in, and we do interview people afterward. And we investigate what they say, and we document what they say. It's just not in the public domain. So there are numerous cases, and I'm going to skip through all this. And I named some of the physical effects that they have that were denied as possible because they were, just not possible then. A book called Unconventional Flying Objects from Paul H. Hill, very illuminating as an attempt to understand the physical effects from the point of view of modern physics. Paul worked at NASA for many years. He became a kind of terminal for stories within NASA. The official position of NASA is that they don't exist. Although one person did say to me when I was querying him about something, he said, and besides, Mr. Thieme, we don't determine when they show up. They're not in our control. Well, Paul worked there and had his own sightings and began to experiment with means of propelling disks to see if he could imitate everything that had been observed and understand it within the limited constraints of our physics, and compiled this information on the proviso ordered by NASA to say nothing during his lifetime, but he wrote the book and his daughter Julie published it posthumously, and in it he describes the effects of the plasma. For example, the changes of color, which have been observed varying times during the day or night, depending on what is seen, ultraviolet, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, and infrared. All UFO colors stem from energetic ionizing radiation or radiations generated by the UFO, which ionized the air. Of all the visible colors, red and orange correspond to the least energy. Again, no fool. According to the color chart, blue requires relatively high activation energy. Blue, white, and blue, white are the common colors observed during high-power operation. The blue of the high-power maneuver or high-speeds operation corresponds to the strong radiation peaks of nitrogen, which he will discuss next. A blend of all the colors tends to white, but with blues predominant, it goes to blue-white, as in an electric arc. There's no mystery, he says, about what's causing this. It's a plasma. It's a plasma. There were plasmas around the UFO because of its propulsion system, which ionized the air around it and which changed colors predictably in accordance with the physical laws, which we know as an indication of the intensity of the energy. Couldn't publish it. His daughter had to bring it out posthumously. And his daughter says, he was afraid. He was afraid. I'll go ahead and say it now because he's dead. The main agency he was fearful of was the DIA, where it got to the point where he told me never to say that acronym in front of anyone or repeat it. But now that he's gone and I've mentioned it to other people, I can say it. No one has ever seriously criticized his physics within the constraints of our understanding of physics and what it is. My dad did describe his sighting, she told me, especially the one with four vehicles, the first sighting he talks about. He went to report it to the Air Force. Blue Book was in effect, and they dismissed him. He said, I work at NASA. Check my credentials. And then they paid attention to him. But at NASA, he was forbidden to talk about it, and some people blacklisted him, and he was excluded from projects. They thought he was a loony. They thought he was an oddball or a renegade. As her saying it, the little major said, we don't want to be thought of as loonies if we're associated with Richard. Why was he told not to talk about it, I asked her. It was official policy that they didn't exist. His boss specifically said, just don't talk about it. All right. I don't know how many people have told me things like that over time. This is why I finally got to the point after 30 years of listening to people in the silence of the office, the confessional when I was a priest, and subsequently in the intelligence community and security world of detailed reports, 30 years, it begins to accumulate because it makes you crazy to be told don't talk about it. It makes you crazy to be told that it doesn't exist when all of the evidence is not only abundant but incontrovertible. I talked to John Alexander, who wrote this book, Future War, Non-Lethal Weapons in 21st Century Warfare. And John talked about electronic stun guns and light beams and electromagnetic pulse weapons, things that were observed and reported and documented in tedious detail that were said not to exist. Just go through magazines like Aviation Week and Space Technology. Let me just read you the titles of the articles because I just got the 10-minute sign. DARPA eyes materials for morphing aircraft. We've been working on these things for years, materials that change shape and change contour and enable different things, fighting with photons. This is a directed energy weapons conference to which I was invited, the latest technology, biological impacts, power sources, high-powered microwaves, high-energy lasers, and focused beam strengths. Everybody knows these exist now because we've built them. Stunned progression, non-lethal weapons. How to make an object invisible. You've read the physics of that as we're working our way through the spectrum and making objects seem to be simply not there. The wraps come off the cloak of invisibility. Behold the appearance of the invisibility cloak. Small UAVs will carry disposable pulse weapons. U.S. Air Force acknowledges beam weapon readiness. Lasers, HPM weapons, near operational status. New shared technology will sustain our weapons edge. Microwave weapons will be ready for Iraq. And on and on. I wish you could just read article after article after article. The beams of light. The intensity of the energy, which paralyzed people. We knew it was happening. Now, where else is the knowledge of that? Remember what that general said. Do you think we're going to ignore something like this? So you get stories like the man who told me that he was given material to analyze. What is this alloy, and how can it be made? And he looked at it. I mean, he did a full, thorough analysis. And he went back and he said, where did you get this? And they said, it's Russian. And he said, bullshit. The Russians can't make this. We can't make this. I don't know anybody who could make this. Leaned forward and said, I said, it's Russian. And this is how it's managed. The material on which we have been doing research has sometimes been fed through the appropriate channels to the people who do the research. How else would you do it? I'd do it exactly that way. Unfortunately, there are cases where the qualities of experience have a characteristic called strangeness, where people feel as if they're entering a cone of silence, where they don't hear birds sing or insects chirp, as if space-time itself is distorted. But what is space-time? As it is perceived by the apparatus of cognition, which we in our exalted state as top mammal for the moment think is the way it is. It isn't the way it is. It's the way we frame it. It's the way we build it. I've got lots of examples of that I don't have time to go into. So I'm just going to just kind of jump ahead to a conclusion. What are these people who have looked at it all their lives long, what do they think? What do they think is going on? Why isn't there fuller disclosure? Now that we have such good evidence known throughout the popular culture that the phenomena, when you look at it through the years, come and go, exposing itself, testing, teasing, doing something, exists. Well, a friend of mine is a veteran journalist. I probably shouldn't use his name, but he's a veteran journalist. Decades of honored and acknowledged work exploring aviation technology and other areas. He has a source in the Air Force, I believe. He is an Air Force fighter pilot himself, who was invited to a meeting to discuss the possibility of disclosure. His friend said, and he sworn to secrecy as to where and when and who, so you can say, Richard, you're making it up. And some people will say, I'm making the whole thing up. Before he went to the meeting, his friend was 100% in favor of it. He saw no reason, as I am saying to you, why shouldn't we know? We, the people of the planet, know and seize our own destiny, blah, blah, blah. Why wouldn't we know? What's going on? Why shouldn't we know? He was 100% for disclosure. He went to the meeting, and when he came back, my friend said, I've just never seen anything quite like it. 180-degree reversal. He said, no way. There's no way we should do this now. Well, his question was, are we just not ready for it or what? And, of course, this is where you get the Twilight Zone music, and we become incapable of doing anything other than speculating, but the people I've talked to about it at the highest levels I can reach, which is not official at all, it's all speculation, think that it would have such a serious impact on our societal underpinnings and our religious web, which in intangible ways holds together this society. See, you walk down the hall, you know, let's turn left, let's go get dinner, let's go to this talk, let's do this, let's do that. Society hangs together by consensus and a willingness to accept the agreements we have made with one another that this is what we'll consider real. This is what, therefore, is real. We will not see beyond the frame of the picture or the ground. We will see the picture only and not the ground or frame that contains it, because that would alter what we see when we look at the picture in the frame and the ground of being that contains it. So whatever it was that he heard at that meeting, it's congruent with, consistent with, the policies that have been in operation for a long time. Sure, things do leak out. Has there been a progressive revelation such that most of you know what's going on by now about some of this? I don't know. How much is intentional? I have a whole section here that I didn't get into on how information is managed and how disinformation is worked so successfully and with such subtlety. The bottom line is the world is not what you think. It really is not the way it looks to normal consensus reality. And for whatever reasons, the decision was made and sustained that whatever research went into the field, do you think we would ignore something like this? Went dark, like the atom bomb went dark, and more work and research than ever has gone dark since World War II and is funded covertly, at the very least, for dual use. It doesn't mean a conspiracy. It means it's the way it is. It's how things are. And the only way we can find out how things really are under the way they seem is to do the research and to look at the data and to read case after case after case after case and look for alternative explanations and have the best minds do the work and do it in the way that those men I mentioned have, as an invisible college outside the boundaries of normal science and its validated, sanctioned investigations, in order to, at the very least, uncover whatever there is to uncover, because that's what it means to be a scientist, that's what it means to be a hacker, that's what it means, in my understanding, to be a human being. I'm sorry I rushed through some of this and gave short shrift to some. It's huge. I've accumulated an extraordinary amount of information about it and about the people who have looked closely at it, so of course I'm passionate about it. But more than that, I want to know what's going on in the universe. I want to know what's going on in our galaxy. I want to know what's going on. That's what a hacker does, right? Okay. Questions? Thank you. I should say before I forget, I have a few copies left of my collection of nonfiction. I'm going to make a special offer today. They're $20 and I'll sign them. They're collections of the nonfiction that indicated how my thinking got in the directions it did. But if anyone wants one here at this conference, I have a collection of short stories. Why did I start writing fiction? We have a little time because it's the last session. I start writing fiction because friends in the intelligence community, yes? Okay. I'm sorry. Let me finish the paragraph. It's a long paragraph. Friends in the intelligence community and my friend, the journalist, said, you can't talk about what you know in nonfiction. You will be ridiculed and dismissed. So write fiction. So I published over 30 stories in the last couple of years. They're going to be brought out next year in a collection called Mind Games. My favorite response was from an NSA guy who called up when he read Zero Day Roswell, and he said, 95% of this story is not fiction, but the key to the code is knowing which 95%. At any rate, these, I've got a few left. These are for sale for $20, with the other book sent to you if you give me your contact information at no additional cost as soon as it comes out.